If you have your Bibles, I invite you to turn to the New Testament book of 1 Corinthians chapter 1. This device, as you're turning there, this device is not foreign to you. It's the bigger version of the little version. The little version is called a mousetrap. This is, then, a rat trap. What an ingenious invention, don't you think? I'm going to do my best not to hurt my fingers in this little endeavor, but you have this little rod that attaches into this little device called a paddle. It's not working, and the last thing I want to do is have pure agony while I'm in front of you. Okay, and the most important part of this device is this little piece of metal right here. These guys are clogging their ears already. I love it. This little device in the middle is called a paddle. And the paddle is where you put the bait, right? And this vile creature, his character and his conduct must go, right? Must cease. By all means possible. And so when you bait it, the little critter comes in, hits that. I'm not going to do it with my finger, I can assure you. You catch the device. Look what it did. It destroys said animal. Well, I want you to keep this in mind because this word is in our language. And we use it, maybe not as frequently, but it is not foreign to us by any means. Paul writing in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18, "For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since the wisdom of God, For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for signs, Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ and Him crucified. To the Jews, a stumbling block, to the Gentiles, foolishness. But to those who are the called both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisest of men, and the weakness of God is stronger than the strength of men." God's gospel is His genius plan to save. But this passage tells us three very important things that I want you to know. As you wrestle with the gospel, as you embrace the gospel, as you choose to live by the gospel, these three things you need to understand. First of all, it is an unbelievable message. Now, I say that tongue-in-cheek, right? Because Paul has already told us, for those who believe, for those of us who are in this longevity of believing. But understand that this is an unbelievable message. It is the word, the message of the cross. That is the gospel. Okay? Paul really condensed it in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. For I tell you this, that Jesus Christ died according to the Scriptures, that He was buried, that He was raised again according to the Scriptures. That's the gospel. That's the message. That's the word that is preached. But it is a message where the centrality of the cross is evident. Now, I want you to understand about the cross. The cross was the ultimate torture chamber. Okay, it wasn't a pretty sight whatsoever. In this place, they aimed to humiliate, shame, dishonor. It was incredibly, incredibly painful, and it was there that you died. Nobody came back from the cross. Nobody came down from the cross. You go up on the cross, that's where your last breath will be. This idea of the cross is a problem. This is what makes it unbelievable. To die then on the cross is the ultimate picture. I want you to hear this. To die on the cross is the ultimate picture of a useless, good-for-nothing life. A shameful and pitiful end to a life of failure. That's what the message of the cross. When the Romans did it, that's what they were doing. You are a loser. You are a nobody. Your life is a failure, and this is how we're going to prove it. Therefore, a crucified Messiah was an oxymoron. It's incongruous. It's contradictory. And what does he say in verse 23? It is a stumbling block to the Jews. It is foolishness to the Gentiles. Let me tell you these words. Little flapper. Remember the flapper? That flapper right there, that little plate right there, is called a scandal. That's the Greek word. You've learned Greek this morning. Scandal. I want to give you another Greek word. Moron. Okay? You got these two words memorized? Scandal and moron. For you see, when the Jews looked at the cross, the message of the cross, what they saw was scandal. What they saw was a loser who led an empty life, now ending his life in the most shameful, pitiful way possible. That kind of Messiah does not exist. And it's moronic to the Gentiles. It's literally the word moron. So when you're driving down the road and somebody cuts you off, you go, "You moron." That's exactly what the Gentiles are. Okay? They're seeing the cross, the message of the cross, as moronic. The very character, the very essence of the person isn't worth thinking about. In fact, let me read you this quote. It's from Cicero. Cicero at the time was in defense of a guy named Rabinus, whose trial was instituted by Julius Caesar. He initiated this. This is what Cicero said. The very word cross should be removed not only from the presence of a Roman citizen, but from his thoughts, his eyes, his ears. It's moronic. It's scandalous. It's unbelievable. But God's plan was meant to be scandalous. Hear this. He begins by saying the word of the cross. I'm going to unpack that in a second, but it's definitive. The cross is both the starting point and the ending point. And in the middle, it's the dividing point. Okay? So it's the beginning point. It's the ending point. And in the middle, it's the dividing point. It's a razor blade. It's a razor's edge. And the intent is to divide. The intent is to separate, to push aside. It is at one and the same time a hideous thing to be shunned and the beauty of God's ordained instrument. It is one and the same. And that's where Paul is saying, to those who are perishing, this thing is moronic. This thing is filled with baloney. But to those of us who are believing, it is the power of God. Remember Romans chapter 1, verse 16. We looked at it for 2 whole weeks. I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, for the Jew first and for the Greek. For in it, that is in the gospel, a righteousness of God is revealed that moves along faith to faith, in abundance of faith, as faith is growing and faith is multiplying. This is important for us to realize. Paul, in his proclamation, says that there is, human beings are on a journey. To those, first of all, who are perishing. It's a word that literally means those on their way to ruin. Okay, so there's a group of people who are on their way to ruin. When they hear the gospel message, when they hear the word of the cross, their initial response is going to be, this is scandalous, this is foolishness. But it's a journey, it's a process. Paul is saying there can be a point in time where they take the exit ramp. They get off the, in the words of a famous 70s rock band, the highway to hell. They get off of that road. And now they're on the path of the ones believing. Understand that both of those are linear progressions. It's a definition of a journey. It's not a statement that this is the only thing left. So everyone you see, everyone you bump into outside of these walls, they're either going to be on the journey of faith or they're on the road to ruin. And the gospel message is the only thing that works. It is, to an unbelieving mind, to an unbelieving attitude, to an unbelieving heart, an unbelievable message. Secondly, it is an exclusive message. Now, I already pointed out, but the Apostle Paul uses a definite article on purpose. A definite article is specific. When he's talking about something, when he says the candle, he's talking about this one right here, okay? The candle, not candles like it, not even candles that may look identical to it, but he's talking about this one right here. It is exclusive of the other three. And that's what Paul is saying about the word of the cross. It is an exclusive message. It is a statement that is radically exclusive. And I want to tell you, because it is exclusive, it is offensive to a contemporary culture. Because it is exclusive, it is by then its nature offensive. I will tell you, whether it's ours or cultures of all time, they become livid about the exclusivity of the gospel. It rankles them. I like that word. It rankles them. It causes a consternation. When you say this is the only way of salvation, you're proclaiming an exclusive message, it will get kickback. Our culture has four ways. Maybe more. This is how they push an alternative narrative that says the gospel is not exclusive. Number one is relativism. Relativism is the belief that promotes this. Absolutely, there are no absolutes. Francis Schaeffer, who wrote a book back in the 1970s, How Shall We Then Live? He was a believer, an amazing philosopher, and lived in Switzerland. Said when a culture gets to a place where there are no absolutes, that becomes its absolute. Do you hear that? When a culture like ours that says there are no absolutes, that becomes the absolute. So by its own statement, it is contradictory. What they are saying is the gospel is not absolute. There are other ways. It is not exclusive. So we're going to make it relativistic. We're going to declare absolutely that there are no absolutes. Relativism. Number two, pluralism. Pluralism is the belief that expresses truth by declaring that everything is true. What is your truth is your truth. What is my truth is my truth. Everybody has their own truth. There isn't a universal ultimate truth. It is truth that you and I make up. It is our truth. And what is really fascinating to me is when your truth and my truth are contradictory at the same time. When we have left rational thinking way behind. It's back there somewhere. But there's a thing called the law of non-contradiction, which says two statements that are polar opposites cannot both be true at the same time. If I say I'm in New York and I am in Dayton at the same time, that is contradiction. It is the law of non-contradiction. It says I can't possibly be in both places at the same time. I can be in both places several hours apart, several days apart, but I cannot simultaneously be in both places at the same time. When we say that truth is relative, truth is what you make it out to be, it is this pluralistic idea that everybody gets a say in what truth really is. The purpose of that is to say there's no exclusive truth. There's no truth that exists that overarches any of those. And I will tell you, that is the place where the seeds of propaganda begin to grow. Because everything is true. And nothing is true. That's why culture wrestles with what I would call the intolerable intolerance of tolerance. Where, as believers, we cannot possibly tolerate multiple truths at the same time. So we're intolerant. And because we're intolerant, they're intolerant to our intolerance to the tolerance. You see how it works? It is an exclusive message. Number three, humanism. Humanism is the belief that human beings are the center, the measure, the end of all things. The end game is always self-fulfillment, self-realization. It is the greatest good. This comes out of a philosophy known as Marxism. Karl Marx was not an atheist. Okay, I want you to hear that. He was not an atheist. He believed in God. He hated God. And that hatred spawned humanism, where he says God is no longer the center, the end of all things. I am the center, the end of all things. I was sharing with the elders as we were praying, or before we were praying, that there is a mantra in our culture that is being fed over and over, and people are eating it, they're swallowing it, they're digesting it, and they're living by it. It begins with this: I deserve, fill in the blank. I deserve to not graduate from high school and make $90,000 a year. I deserve that. There is a number of people that CBC gets a call from to help in financial assistance, but their lifestyle is one of repetitive, I deserve. And so all of their resources going in to satisfy what I deserve and not take care of what I need. My commitments, my obligations, my rent, my food, my children. But I deserve. When anybody begins to say, I deserve, they're humanists. They don't deny the existence of God. They just say God no longer is in first place. He's no longer the end of all things. Relativism, pluralism, humanism, finally, paganism. Paganism is the belief that nature is God. And reconnecting and interacting with this universal reality symbiotically brings meaning to life. We live in a state, one side in particular, that worships nature. That decisions that are made for the queen of nature, not for the betterment of humanity. Because the focus is no longer there. The focus is there. It's really an animistic belief system. It really is that God exists in the things of nature. There are probably other isms that are out there, but understand the flow. What's going on? When the gospel, the word of the cross, is proclaimed, it is an exclusive message. There isn't another message like it. Because it is God's genius idea of how to save. And Paul doesn't mince any words. He says, in this, verse 24, is the power of God and the wisdom of God. God is displaying how wise this is. You know why this is scandalous? The gospel is so scandalous because it shows that human beings are in a death spiral and there's no way out. Absolutely in a death spiral and there's no way out. Some weeks ago I saw a plane in South America, it was a video, fall out of the sky. It literally fell out of the sky. Death spiral. And there was nothing anyone could do except watch it fall to the ground. Gravity's working 100% of the time. I test it many times a day. And it still works, I can guarantee you. It is an exclusive message. And it is scandalous and moronic because humanity does not want to believe it's in a death spiral. Humanity doesn't want to believe that life is really out of their control. They don't want to embrace the reality that something outside of themselves must save. It is an exclusive message. Paul asks three rhetorical questions in verse 20. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater? He wasn't asking their location, okay? What he was saying is this. Of these three questions, the first question is about the shrewd, what we call the sage, or somebody who's streetwise. Somebody who knows how to manage life, right? They're streetwise. They've got this figured out. Paul is saying, where's that person who's really got the kutzpah, who's really got it together in understanding how to navigate through this life? That person would be, I talked to a person of political influence in our community that said, Washington is one of two states in the United States where you can, if you manipulate the system the right way, can make $100,000 a year by doing nothing. That's streetwise. They're figuring it out. This is how life works, and I'm going to get it. Second question is all about the one who disputes. He's the expert. I've heard these words come from politicians in our state. We know what is best for you, so just follow or do what we say. We're informing you what is best for you. You don't know what's best for you. Where is that expert? Number three. Third question. It's the one who discusses, the debater. The debater is the one who has an agenda, who wants to prove by this loquacious speech, that would be like smooth talking, by sounding really smart on the subject and being able to throw a wrench in the works, right? Paul is saying, where are those? Here's the smart guys of the world. Where are they? Because the foolishness of God is wiser than the wise guys. The stuff that people are saying is moronic is actually life, and what they're saying is moronic. It's weak. It's insufficient. And it will incredibly end in disaster. Thirdly, it is a demanding message. It's an unbelievable message. It is a divisive message. It is also a message that is very demanding. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote in The Cost of Discipleship, when Jesus Christ calls a person, he bids them come and die. That's not really a message that many people hear about, right? When you come to the gospel, it's a death. Listen to some of these. In the sense that it is costly, Jesus said in Luke chapter 14, he who comes to me and does not hate his father, his mother, his brothers, his sisters, his children, yes, even his own life is not worthy of me. Now, Jesus isn't supporting or promoting a hatred gospel, right? What he is calling for is a costly gospel. It will cost you in your relationships. Further, Jesus said in Matthew 16, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. That's exclusive again. It's part of the exclusive gospel. You can't follow all the other things and me at the same time. It doesn't work like that. What Jesus is cutting out over and over and over is, when we talked about this several years ago, saying the gospel plus something else equals salvation. I can embrace the gospel, but it's also good works, or it's also pursuing what I deserve, or it's fulfillment or self-realization, or whatever you add something else to the gospel, you've negated the first part of that equation. Because if it's the gospel plus something else, it's the something else that's the center of importance, and the gospel is pushed aside. Jesus said, if you're going to come after me, you have to deny yourself. You have to take up your cross. You have to be willing to put to death those things that are preventing you from the third thing, following me. Following me. In Matthew 19, you remember the story of the rich young ruler who was a very religious young man. I mean, he had his act together. And where this question came from, I can't tell you, okay? But what must I do to be saved, right? Which tells me something, that all of the good things he was doing to keep the law left him empty inside. So Jesus, starting at that point, said, well, you've heard that it was written by Moses, do this, do this, do this, do this. It's the last six commands of the Ten Commandments. And I can see a big smile come on his face, and he's going, I did it. I did it. Redemption is mine. And Jesus said, very good, you've done that. Now I want you to go and sell everything that you have, give it to the poor, and come follow me. It says he walked away a very sad man because he owned a lot of things. He was a very wealthy man. Now that isn't the paradigm for Christianity. God does not call every believer to sell what they have, give to the poor, and somehow scrounge around to figure out life, right? But understand that the intent of what Jesus is saying. Everything else that you're holding dear in your life has to go if you're going to follow me genuinely. It has to go. You have to get rid of it. Because it becomes your own stumbling block. When you're reading about what the gospel demands are, it trips something in you. And you say, man, I know that I need to do that, but I don't want to do that. It is a costly gospel. It's the gospel also that makes radical demands. Radical demands such as 1 Peter chapter 1. You must be holy as I am holy. Whew! And I want to tell you something. When we as human beings, you know, get out the binoculars and really enlarge that thing and go, I have to be holy as God is holy. And so we go, let's get to work. Right? And what happens when we say that? Now we're working on trying to be holy by ourselves. And all of a sudden it isn't working so well. And we're going, oh my gosh. But again, it's about getting rid of all of the things in your life that make you unholy so that God can put His holiness in you. Clean house. Get rid of stuff. When we cleaned out the garage next door yesterday, and by the way, I'm still wheezing and coughing and sneezing because of the dust bowl that we created. But there was a lot of junk in there. There really was. And I felt bad for Joe because Joe goes, I'll take things home that can burn. And he looked like Jed Clampett when we were done. There was so much stuff in the back of his truck. And it's like, all this stuff we've been saving. Why? Because the great phrase in churches, we might need it someday. So since I've been here 23 years, there's stuff that's been in there that we might need someday and that we've never needed. And I'm telling you, there's some stuff that you carry around in your life that you've been carrying around for 20 years, for 30 years, and you don't need it. You're not going to ever need it again. And you got to clean it out. Why? Because in that moment, when there's space, finally in your soul, God fills it with holiness. Or righteousness, Romans chapter 6. Or faithfulness, Acts chapter 14, 2 Timothy chapter 3. It is in this moment, because of the demands of the gospel, where mere profession is never enough. Profession is important. Romans chapter 9, verses 10 and 11, tells us that we proclaim, right? There is that moment of declaration. But profession is never enough. And I want to tell you that many Christians wrestle at this point with the demands of the gospel. They are saved. They're genuinely saved. But they struggle to fulfill the demands of the gospel because it is very demanding. God intended it that way. There are people, churches, Christians, who attempt to lower the demands of the gospel. Let us let culture dictate how the gospel is lived out. A church that my daughter and son-in-law had visited and considered going to on Easter Sunday, on Resurrection Sunday, had a mechanical bull in the entryway and a giant Easter egg hunt. And their intent was just to draw people from the world. And look, we can do things that are just like the world. The demands of the gospel are not what you think. So come, let's have a good time together. Let's feel good together. What are they saying underneath is that you deserve this. You deserve a gospel that is easy. There are people that accommodate the message. Jesus didn't really mean the severe things he said about the kingdom gospel message. John chapter 6 gives us a story where he had fed 5,000. It was a miraculous event. And by the way, that is 5,000 males, men. They didn't count females and children. So it could easily have been 10,000 people that Jesus fed. That's why the disciples were incredulous when Jesus said, well, why don't you just find something for them to eat? And they look in their wallet and they go, oh, not a chance. We can't even feed my family, let alone 10,000 people. So Jesus feeds them. And they're amazed and they follow him around. And they want this. I'm thinking it was pretty tasty bread. I mean, when Jesus turned the water into wine, it was the best wine anybody had ever tasted. So my guess is this bread was like two thumbs up. And they're going, all right. And if Jesus can do that, I don't have to bake anymore. I don't have to go to the market to buy anymore. Let's just follow Jesus around and let him keep feeding us. Right? That's a great idea. We just keep going over and over and over. Jesus, just give us this bread. And then he says this incredibly crazy thing. I'm the bread, so you have to eat me. What does it say? They all left. What you say is too hard for us to grasp. And we're not going to... You're advocating cannibalism? No. I'm telling you that I am the source of your life. And unless I am the only source of your life, you will never be full. You're just going to keep eating bread for no reason. Dietrich Bonhoeffer called it cheap grace. It's a discipleship that tries to offer from man to Christ what it looks like. I'm going to determine what the demands of discipleship look like. Humor me for just a moment. This is a profound book, The Cost of Discipleship, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He wrote it. The seeds of it were before he was in prison, but he didn't get it out until he was actually in prison. But he has this entire chapter on cheap grace. Cheap grace means justification of sin without the justification of the sinner. That means sin management. We're taking care of the things that trouble us, but we ourselves are not being transformed. Cheap grace is not the kind of forgiveness of sin which frees us from the toils of sin. Cheap grace is the grace we bestow on ourselves. This is how we're easy on the gospel. This is how the gospel is more palatable, he says. Cheap grace is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance. Baptism without church discipline, that is accountability, if I can read between the lines. He's saying that one of the difficulties of our churches, we're no longer accountable to one another for our lives. And so we sin in the closet, we sin in private, and nobody else ever knows what's going on because we're trying to create a baptism that eliminates accountability. It is commission without confession. It is saying I'm sorry without genuine confession. It is costly because it costs a man his life. That's what he's saying. It's not cheap grace, it's costly grace. What the demands of the gospel are costly. They're intended to be costly. That's why he called it a treasure hidden in a field. For the sake of it, a man will gladly go and sell everything he has. It is the pearl of great price, which the merchant sells all of his goods in order that he might attain it. Costly grace is the gospel that must be sought again and again and again. A gift that must be asked for. A door at which, when there's a knock, he opens. It is costly because it costs a man his life. It is grace because it gives a man his only true life. It is costly because it condemns sin. And it is grace because it justifies the sinner. Above all, it is costly because it costs God the life of his Son. And what has cost God much can never be cheap to us. Above all, it is grace. Because God did not reckon his Son too dear a price to pay for your life and for my life, but delivered him up for us. Costly grace is the incarnation of God. It is a demanding message. And because of that, it's scandalous. It sounds too much. It's too great a price to pay. God's asking too much from me. Anything less is not the word of the cross. A little cross that we have behind the screen, some of you might be wearing a cross, was never intended to be jewelry. Was never intended to be ornamentation. It was always intended to be the dividing line of humanity. And God said, I love you so much. There's my Son. And the world is looking at it as his life was useless, that he was a loser, that he was a good for nothing, that he accomplished nothing with his life. And I'm telling you, there's salvation. What is at stake in the lives of those who as yet do not know Christ? I would dare say it's their eternity. What are you willing to surrender for the gospel of the cross? Where have you made cheap grace imitation of the real thing? Do you live as if the gospel were absolutely exclusive? Almighty Father, I thank you for your word. Oh my goodness, it is powerful. The truth of it really is the power of God and the wisdom of God. We couldn't figure all this out by ourselves. And quite frankly, we don't really understand it all by ourselves. That's why we invite you in. Teach us. Nurture us. Encourage us. Comfort us. Show us the areas of our own clutter that need to be removed. Some of us are carrying around a spiritual cancer, and we need to give you permission to be the surgeon and cut it out of our lives so that it's no longer a hindrance. This word of the cross, the message of Christ, is really moronic to those who are on the road of ruin. But to those of us who genuinely accept it, who genuinely believe it, it is the power of God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for creating the solution to our problem. In Jesus we pray. Amen.